Welcome, writers, game masters, and creatives, to the World Builders Tavern. Today, we are talking about the fantasy YA novel Vespertine. Spoiler warning, if you have not yet read this book, we are going to be going in-depth, so beware. But other than that, you should just grab an ale and pull up a chair. I'm Emma, your friendly barkeep, along with Allison.
Hello!
Christiana.
Hi.
And our very special guest, the author of Vespertine herself, Margaret Rogerson. Welcome, Margaret!
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're so excited to have you. Would you like to give yourself a little bit of an introduction?
Sure. My name is Margaret Rogerson. I'm an author of young adult fantasy. I've published 3 full-length novels and 1 novella. My most recent novel is Vespertine, about a girl who's training to be a nun who teams up with an evil spirit bound to a saint's relic to save the world.
Amazing. Love I was going to ask you to intro the book afterwards. You already did that. So that's perfect. So we love to kick off our discussions with authors about their world building process. So can you tell us a little bit about your world building process, either in general or particularly for Vespertine? How did that get started for you?
Oh my gosh. So for Vespertine specifically, it was an idea that I'd wanted to write for a really long time. One thing that all of my books have in common is that they are all about, essentially, in my opinion, the same thing, which is a main character who befriends a non-human creature. Mm. And
I love
that. That's like the one, it's the one thing that I'm interested in writing about, to be honest, and it's probably at its heart what every book that I write will be about. And I had always wanted to write a ghost as the non-human character for a book. And I had also always wanted to write a book in which I'm a big fan of the undead and bones, as we were just discussing.
Same. Yeah.
We're talking about bones before the podcast started. We have the right guests on.
Yeah.
Yes. I feel very at home. So I wanted to write a book that had a ghost as one of the 2 main characters, and I had also always wanted to write a book in which the magic system was based around religion, and this seemed like a good opportunity to sort of mash those 2 ideas together, and that was what inspired the idea to make the spirits bound to saints' relics and to be sort of the fuel, if you will, for the magic system. So that was the idea behind the world building for Vespertine specifically.
Very cool. Did that come first and then the story came after?
Yeah, I think that was really the first kernel of an idea. I think for me, my books are typically inspired by a type of relationship that I want to explore and the dynamics of the relationship. So it's hard to remember because it was so long ago, and this is an idea that's been marinating in my head for a really long time. I think before I even wrote Sorcery of Thorns, I was sort of toying around with the idea of this book. Yes, so it's hard to remember specifically what came first, but I do suspect that that is what came first.
I can't decide if Artemisia or the Revenant are my favorite character in this book because they're both so fun. I really love Artemisia. Am I saying her name right? Artemisia.
Yeah.
Okay. I really love her because just her anxiety and how she doesn't understand how to interact with people or comprehend facial expressions, and that as someone with anxiety very much speaks to me.
Yeah.
And I just love how sarcastic the Revenant is and how at first you called her or them evil in your description, but they aren't really, like, they're misunderstood.
I would agree with that. I feel like the evil aspect is sort of your first impression. So I will, like, say it that way as a hook, but of course, as the book goes on, you do find out there are additional layers to the Revenant.
And this is a spoilery podcast, so we can tell our listeners that.
Spoil whatever you want.
Super.
That the Revenant turns out to be a good character that I just love. Yeah. But I really like that you don't know at first, because nuns are trained that these things are evil. That was really fun.
Yeah, I definitely laughed out loud quite a few times when he called her a horrible nun. But, like, it was usually when he's trying to be helpful, he's like, run, you horrible nun. Or, like, or when he's trying to, I think there's when she was sick and he was trying to, like, make her eat or something. And he, like, is yeah. being really rude.
Oh,
like,
super interesting yeah, that you think of it, you think of the Revenant as male. Because I,
oh, did you not?
Yeah, I was... kind of thought female. Oh. And then I tried to stop assigning
my
gender.
My mind is
they
blown.
Don't actually, yeah.
No,
I'm
totally.
I'm going to add wow. in as the resident non-binary person. Yeah. I very much appreciated the passage where, I pronounce it as Artemisia for some reason, but where she was like, you know, like, what were you? Do you remember anything about your life? And he was like, oh, like, they kind of threw it off as, like, male, female, it doesn't really matter, I am who I am, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that to me was, like, I actually highlighted that passage, and I was like,
yeah, I like
yes,
that.
That's the point. That's the whole thing, right? So I really like that. And so for me, in my head, I used gender-neutral pronouns for the Revenant the entire time. 'Cause it just...
Thank yeah. you.
As a gender neutral person, I connected with that, and I thought it was really cool where I was like, yeah, you're right, like, that's not the point. The point is the story and what's happening and the opinions and things like that. So
oh, thank yeah. you, that means a lot to me. Yeah, the Revenant is officially a non-gendered entity.
Hey,
love it.
I will switch my internal. That's so interesting that we three read it and each yeah. took away, like, a different or, like, yeah. assigned a different personality or gender.
Yeah,
that is really interesting.
Funny. Yeah.
It annoys me about my brain that it wants to assign one of the binaries to yeah. things already because I want to train it to stop doing that. So, yeah. Like,
but
like,
that's also
it's hard
society.
To unlearn.
Yeah. yeah, I was going to say mm-hmm. that's also society and it's hard to unlearn those things, right? So,
but I'm
yeah.
trying.
Yeah,
so. You
it was
are.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, as a tangent, this is really interesting, but in French, you know, every object has a gender. There's
yeah.
no mm. such thing right. as an it in, mm. in
yeah.
French. Uh-huh. So they had a little bit of a difficulty translating Vespertine for that reason, because they don't have its pronouns, if you will,
yeah.
or
yeah.
even really they them, I don't think.
Oh.
So
yeah.
I think they defaulted to male pronouns, but with the implication that it wasn't really male.
Interesting.
That's just what
yeah.
they... Yeah.
I actually wanted to ask you about if there's French influence, because I noticed
yeah.
a lot of your mm. names
it, yeah,
places,
like,
it sounds Bonsant French.
Sounds
yeah.
like
yes.
St. Boniface to
yeah.
us Winnipeggers. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, for sure. I think it was because... the story was very, very, very loosely inspired by Joan of Arc, Artemisia's journey. So I think my brain was just kind of like, oh, France, like,
yeah.
why not? I haven't done a pseudo French fantasy setting before. So.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
yeah. Like Marguerite is definitely like, to me, it was like, oh
yeah,
yeah. definitely sounds
yeah,
like
Jean,
a
French Marguerite.
Did
yeah.
I have a question for you. So my middle name is Margaret, fun little fact. And I know,
nice.
Yeah, so Marguerite, I know, is like the French term for daisy, is it? It's a flower, I know.
Is it?
I think it's daisy. Was Marguerite for you as a Margaret, because Margaret and Marguerite, French and English, of the same name, was that like an influence for the character? Do you see yourself in Marguerite?
Honestly, I vastly more relate to Artemisia.
Yeah.
I just thought the name, I feel like on the outside, I look more like a Marguerite, like in terms of my
yeah.
external presentation. But no, I thought that was just kind of a funny coincidence. It just also seemed like the right name for the character. Sometimes a name will just
I
pop
agree.
Into my head. And I,
yeah.
And even if it's sort of, there's something about it that makes it weird, such as, oh, that's my name.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I also, when I write, I almost feel like I don't exist in a way.
Yeah.
Like, I as a person cease to exist. So the name thing doesn't really bother me that much. Like, I could definitely write a character named Margaret or Maggie and not feel like I'm associating with that
yeah.
in any way.
Hmm. Like, you're really getting into Artemisia's head, so it's like she exists and you don't. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I would say, yeah. yeah.
Have you ever written a book in the third person, and is it different? Because all your books are first person, right?
Sorcerer of Thorns is third.
Oh, is it third? Okay.
Yeah. It is a little bit different. For sure. I do feel when I write in first person that I'm more deeply in the character's head. But I think I still do get that sense of being somewhat transported and sort of ceasing to exist regardless of the person that I'm writing in. Yes.
What made you pick first or third for our writers who are listening and trying to decide for themselves?
I've always tried to figure out the answer to that question because sometimes it feels right and sometimes it doesn't. And I don't know why, but I have a couple of suspicions. I think one is whether I feel as though there is a lot of myself in that character. And then another, I think, is how sort of internal the character is. Because, for example, Elizabeth in Sorcery of Thorns, she's very much a person of action rather than deep introspective thought. Whereas I would say both Isabel and Artemisia in my other books have more of an inward sort of thought process, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that does make sense.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, like a lot of what's going on with them is going on the inside rather than the outside. So first person feels perhaps more natural in that sense.
Yeah, well, if you're writing her in third person, there might be more of like, you know, she always talked about how she like her facial expression doesn't match what she's thinking about. So you would maybe get a very different impression of her if you were writing in, you know, third person or from another character's perspective. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, oh, Artemisia comes across very differently to other people than on the inside. That could be a big part of it for her character for sure.
I love how the Revenant's always like, I wish I knew what you look like.
Yeah.
Right now. I need to know that too. Yeah, I need to know what your face is doing because people are afraid of you right now.
Yeah. I also really loved the different perspective we get on the scene where she's trying to, it didn't happen in the book, but they're thinking about the scene where she handed Marguerite a spider to, like, because Marguerite was afraid of spiders, and she was trying to be like, here's something to be afraid of. And then later Marguerite is like, you blankly threw a spider at me. This was terrifying. Yeah. And it's just like the disconnect between the intent and how it came off was just like, oh, yeah.
I love that, because a totally different version of events depending on who is telling that story,
I also wonder how you got the idea of, like, the relics and, like, how that kind of, this sounds silly, but it reminded me of Ghostbusters a little bit, you know, like, kind of, like, capturing a ghost and putting it in a capsule and maybe putting it away. But then the twist was being able to use that relic for your own power. And kind of like what I found really thoughtful and meaningful about the story was kind of this idea that for a long time it was something you were afraid of. So you locked it away and then you used it for your own power. And then there were the select few who actually became friends with it and understood that that wasn't maybe the correct approach to it kind of thing. So I'm kind of curious as to what your influence for that was.
So for the relic specifically, I think it was sort of the when I was merging together the idea of I wanted a ghost to be the main character and I wanted ghosts to be the sort of the supernatural entity in this world. And then I also wanted to do a magic system based around religion. So relics seemed like a natural thing to use as an object of power, sort of. In terms of binding the spirits to the relics, I think I started out, I seem to remember with it just being the Revenant specifically that was bound to a relic. And then I later expanded that idea to be the magic system in general, that there were more than one relic, that it was the whole magic system and that priests and priestesses were carrying these around, able to do different types of magic with them. So I think I've always been intrigued by the idea of a powerful entity of some kind being trapped or bound and imprisoned and used for some purpose. It's not necessarily a super original idea. I feel like it's, you know, like the Sandman, you know, comic and TV show starts that way.
I got some Garth Nix Old Kingdom vibes.
Ooh,
which is like one of my favorite books, so I was very happy about like And he does something similar with, like, the cat Mogget is really this scary spirit that's bound. So
yeah. Stabriel was definitely a big influence on this.
Nice.
Yeah. Yes, I also was like, oh yeah, this feels Stabriel coded.
Oh, good. I'm glad that came across. It was a very formative book for me, and I wanted to create a world that had sort of a very coherent feeling to it, like the world building and the magic system and the characters all sort of created this very unified feeling atmosphere. I don't know if that describes it very well, but when I think of Sabriel, it gives me such a distinct and specific feeling. With the necromancy and the bells and like the different layers of the afterlife, it just all seems so like it all fits together really well. And it gives off just this very powerful sense of atmosphere.
Yes.
And I sort of wanted to try to do something similar to that. I tried at least.
I think that totally. I'm living in Europe for the year, and I'm having a great amount of fun going to lots of different ruins. And I feel like this is completely like an old cathedral ruin. Definitely. So I think the like vibe and the atmosphere that you're going for, I think definitely comes across. Like it really feels like this is in a cemetery by a big cathedral at night in the fog.
Oh, wonderful.
I'd love to hear more about the how you were influenced by religion, because I really liked just how thoughtful it was. I find sometimes in sci-fi or fantasy, authors seem to have an agenda about religion, like either I'm going to be like, disprove God and that this is wrong, or I'm going to do the opposite. And I found yours was a more nuanced approach. So how did the religion inspire the world building?
So I am personally an atheist. I grew up in a sort of just a bit of a wishy-washy Christian environment, I would say. Like I went to church sometimes, like non-denominational. But I do really distinctly remember probably around 12 years old when I stopped believing in religion and God, and that was very painful to stop believing in something like that, even though I would never necessarily characterize myself as an extremely religious child, but it was still definitely left an impact on me. And I wanted to write a story in which the religion was not the antagonistic force necessarily. I didn't want to write a story in which the character has the inciting incident and she realizes that everything she believed was wrong and the church is actually evil and it's manipulating her for evil reasons and now she's going to fight the church. I wanted it to be more complicated than that. And I wanted both the villains and the heroes to be religious. And I wanted the main character to undergo a journey of faith where she questions everything that she was taught, but she still is, her faith is still her source of strength at the end of the book, just in a different way. I wanted her to undergo an evolution. I would say The Revenant, with its more skeptical view of religion, is more true to what I personally sort of believe and feel like I would be the Revenant in that dynamic. But I really admire Artemisia's strength of faith and the way in which it lends her such a strength of will. It was very, very interesting to write.
I also really liked how the Revenant is obviously skeptical, but they still respect Artemisia's faith. Like it still, it doesn't, you know, go off on tangents trying to convince her that she's wrong. It's just like, okay, you believe this, whatever. You know, you do you.
I really liked that aspect of the story because I was like, my family is from Ukraine and there was a lot of religious beliefs behind it kind of thing and all that kind of stuff, but I never went to church because my mom was good at being like, no, they'll figure out their own stuff in their own time. And like, you know, I don't want to force that on them. But also like seeing my grandma like pray and stuff like that and all those things. I really liked the approach to religion because I feel like that's similar. That was very similar to my approach to it, where it was very like, maybe it's not for me, but I respect that it's for you and it has like meaning and value and like it improves your life in some way. And then also sometimes maybe it doesn't, like with the divine, right? Where it's like maybe it is a little bit of a fraud, so to speak, right? But both of those things can exist at the same time. It doesn't need to be the extreme. And I totally appreciate what you were saying with the that kind of approach where either it's evil or it's the best and it's the word and it's everything. Instead, Artemisia was kind of like, it's a little bit of both, right? Like there are some things that are true to me and guide me, and there are some things that are kind of more structural and systemic that don't necessarily apply to me. And I feel like that was, I liked it. As a largely non-religious person, I was like, this, it didn't feel too intense about anything, and I really enjoyed it. So
I definitely got a lot of Catholic vibes, probably from the nuns, saints,
and the censors,
and the censors. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
I also got a little bit of Dragon Age vibes. Like, I don't know if you play Dragon Age.
No, but I've heard that before, and I do have lots of friends who are really into Dragon Age. Actually, the friend I have visiting right now is very into Dragon Age.
Nice.
Has told me a lot of the lore.
Yes.
So it is possible that some of that made its way in.
It's one of my favorite game franchises, and I got a little bit, like, there's a big religion component, and, like, the chantry and the... It just kind of reminded me. I really loved Mother Dolores.
Yes.
Oh, I love her. She's amazing. So much.
Oh, since we can do spoilers, she actually initially played the role that Mother Catherine played in the book, and she was killed off. And I loved her so much that I was like, no, I cannot kill this character. So I created...
That was the perfect choice. That was the perfect choice. Yeah.
I created Mother Catherine to replace her. Rest in peace, Mother Catherine.
It's like when an actor comes in for a bit part and the director's like, we're writing a whole new role for you. We love you so much. I love that. That's fantastic.
That's exactly what it was like, yeah.
She's such a fantastic character. I love her.
She was, to me, like my grandma. Like I said, like I didn't grow up in a very religious household, but my grandma's very religious and was very like, I don't know, even just like the description of her, I just imagined her chucking pierogies at like ghosts and stuff, and I was like, yeah, get him! Like, I loved it.
I could definitely see her doing like a Gandalf, you shall not pass kind of thing. Like, I feel like that's like...
But it's just like a whole stack of pet a hair.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, get him!
Yeah. That makes me so happy.
I actually didn't realize, I thought this was a standalone, and then I read somewhere that it's actually a series.
It was originally supposed to be a series, and now it's a standalone.
I mean, it works really well.
There's more coming, and I was so excited. I love it as a standalone, but I also like love the idea of more books in this
world. We
would love
more.
Yeah.
I'm curious about Artemisia's relationship with Leander, if I'm saying that right. I liked that as a socially awkward person, where he's like there, and then you find out he's not evil, and then maybe he's not such a bad guy.
I was totally at the beginning, this is gonna be enemies to lovers. I was like, and then I'm like, no, wait, he's totally evil, that's not happening. And then I'm like, oh, he's not evil, you say. Oh,
wait a second.
The whole journey. So that is the one thing that I'm sad about the book not being a series, is because he was going to be one of the main three characters of the plot arc. Yeah. And I had so many fun things planned, but it didn't work out. I was writing this during the pandemic, and I had just essentially just started it when the pandemic hit, and the publishing schedule just sort of went off the rails. We ended up on a very tight schedule, and they could not push the book back because so many other books had been pushed back. So I essentially finished writing this book like 3 months before it was published. It was bananas.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah. It was totally bananas. The whole ending of the book is essentially still kind of a first draft in a sense, because I was so rushed with the publication schedule. Yeah, so I'm very proud of the way that it turned out given the circumstances, but
I wouldn't have
guessed. Can't tell.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
I did not pick up on that at all. That's fantastic.
Oh, that's good to hear. It's a relief.
It does feel like a book that could exist on its own, but is like open to future stuff. You know what I mean? Like kind of the idea of like Artemisia like being like, and I know I'm going to see him again, and turning the horse and running off.
Yeah.
That in and of itself is like a satisfying ending where you're like, okay, I can imagine what's going to happen.
It's like the Western, kind of the cowboy leaves town and you know he's going to have
exactly. So it's, you're like, there are more adventures. I don't need to see them. If I get to see them, even better. But
yeah.
That's great to hear. That was exactly what I was going for. So it's nice to hear that landed.
Yeah.
Totally. I'm interested in, I really found it refreshing that there wasn't a romance. And I read somewhere, I can't remember if it was you who said, so this might not be true, that Artemisia is supposed to be aromantic or asexual.
Yes.
That's true.
Both. Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
I really appreciated that.
Love
that rep. But did you get like any just... romance is so popular in YA. So, like, what did your editors think about this? Like, why did you make this decision?
Yeah.
How was it received?
So, it's funny because I think that the sort of bananas publication schedule sort of worked in my favor in that sense, because by the time my editor realized that there was not going to be a romance,
it was too late.
It was too late. Yeah, like, definitely, I did, like, beef up, like, I guess, like, you would say the sex appeal of Leander a little bit based on my editor being like, you have to give them something, Margaret. make him slightly less pathetic. So I added, like, a little bit more. Just, like, I beefed up, like, his descriptions a little bit more.
Yeah.
To, like, you know, give the reader something.
For some reason, thought it was going to be that Marguerite was in love with Charles and that Artemisia was in love with Marguerite. That was, the slight... I didn't like, super expect it, but I was like, Marguerite seems real interested in Charles and Artemisia seems real interested in Marguerite. What's happening here?
So actually, I wish I had more time to work on this book, because there were some things that I cut with the intention to put back in later and then just never found a good place to do it because I was so rushed. But Marguerite is bi, and she did have a crush on Artemisia. So if you were picking up on some like little
I
vibes
love
there.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. She actually like, there's this whole passage that I cut where, like, she once almost, like, burned down the dormitories because she had this little shrine to, like, Marguerite had a shrine to, like, one of her female friends, like, in their closet, and it had, like, candles in it.
Yeah.
And she, like, almost, like, and Artemisia was kind of referencing it as, like, the one time that, like, she was not the person who caused the disaster to happen. It was actually Marguerite's fault. Like, she, like, almost burned down the wardrobe with, like, her little shrine to, like, Matilde or something.
That's such a teenage girl thing. I love that.
I know, right? Yeah, right. Yeah. I ended up having to cut that whole chapter, and then I was like, oh, but I want to keep that so bad because it was so funny and adorable. But then I just couldn't figure out where to put it back in, and like, we just didn't have time to spend a lot of time on edits. So I do regret that being cut.
I still got the vibe, though, as, like, a non-binary queer person. I was like, there's some gay stuff happening here.
Yeah.
And I love it.
That's great.
That's great. I'm glad the vibes survived intact.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
I didn't pick up on that, but I'm very oblivious to romantic things. So
yeah, that's fair.
I was like, oh, Marguerite, like grabbing her hand and stuff. Like when they're in danger, like, there's like the one scene. Yeah. And I was like, they're gonna fall in love. But Marguerite is torn between Charles and Artemisia. And I was like, it's gonna be a whole thing. Anyways.
There was that line about how someone left stuff for Artemisia's hands on her bed every night and how she thought it was a nun, but now she wasn't so sure. And I'm like, Marguerite.
Yeah.
Didn't she?
It was, yeah. That was Marguerite. Yeah.
That's so cute. Aww. I love that so much.
That definitely, I didn't so pick sweet. Up on it, but it definitely like makes it now like recontextualizes like why she was so hurt that Artemisia like seemed to hate her and stuff. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Poor Marguerite.
Yeah.
I really appreciated. We had a sort of discussion in this in our chat before, like when we were reading the book, about how Marguerite's character was really interesting because Artemisia seems to think of her as kind of just being like a silly, shallow girl, which is often how teenage girls are viewed, especially by society. And then Artemisia kind of gets humbled a little bit in being like, oh no, she's actually a person with depth and like has thoughts and feelings and talents. And it was really kind of nice to read that and to see, you know, oh no, teenage girls aren't just, you know, silly.
Yeah.
They're people and they're
important. Like gossip. Gossip, like if you're looking at it from like a societal and anthropological?
That sounds good. Yeah. We'll go with that.
It makes sense, right? Like if you're saying this person is dangerous and that's passed on and on and on kind of thing. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. It's worthwhile for society. It's not useless.
Yeah, no, truly. Well, like, and the fact that she finds so much of this information, like, that's, like, a key plot point at one point, is that she just goes around and asks people questions and gets that information and brings it back and it says, okay, no one knows that you're the saint. People have, like, such differing stories. It's not a big deal. Like, you're still safe to move around kind of thing. Like, I thought that was really thoughtful.
Yeah, like, so often it's, I feel like with female characters, sometimes it's, you know, trying to write a strong female character is just, oh, we'll make them a man, but they're a girl.
Yeah.
Whereas it's nice to see things which are stereotypically female or feminine coded being celebrated and used like for good in their own right. And it's like, no, you can be feminine and also be an important character who has agency and who does things. And some great world building that I really appreciated.
Yeah. We're just sitting here complimenting
everything.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Margaret.
Yeah.
I should do this more often. I have noticed with my books that if I was actually just talking to my friend about this probably an hour ago, that if I don't have enough female characters in a story, it doesn't feel right to me. Like, I feel like I need to have a lot of different representations of female characters and have, like, a variety of women in the story, or else it just, for some reason, just doesn't feel right to me. Yeah, I'm not sure why that is, but it definitely is sort of something that...
I mean, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
No complaints.
Always appreciated. Yeah.
Also, me being a big, giant dork, if you were to look at the data of women versus men in a meeting, if women spoke 30% of the time, there are a bunch of studies that show that the men in the meeting will presume that that was the majority of the time. Right?
Yeah.
So, like,
that,
I think
that's
that's like the challenge in including women characters or female characters kind of thing, where it's like, it realistically, even if it's 50-50, some people will interpret it as 80-20 kind of thing. So, like, finding that balance is such a difficult and unnecessary thing. It's rude. Like, it's just real. It's rude. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the pleasures of writing in a YA space, though, is because your readership is very, very, you know, female dominated.
Yeah.
So you don't have those readers who are like, too many women, you know?
Yeah.
There aren't the same expectations as in, say, like, adult epic fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although I feel like things are changing now, for sure, which is good in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah. Just always takes a while slowly to make those shifts.
Yeah.
I had a question about, so Allie had touched on, you know, Artemisia having a lot of anxiety and, like, trouble reading, like, faces and emotions. To me, I interpreted her as very, like, autistic or autistic coded. Was that something that you did intentionally, or were these just kind of her traits that you put together and didn't necessarily, you know, have a diagnosis or something in mind for her?
Yeah, I would say she definitely qualifies as neurodivergent.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that she struggles with are just based on my own personal experiences. And I was actually surprised by the number of people who just were like, oh, this is a great, like, autistic character who is obviously written as autistic. And I was like, oh, that's interesting.
You're like,
Wait, do I need to talk
to a doctor?
Yeah, because a lot of those things were just things that I have always struggled with, particularly as a young person when I was Artemisia's age. So I guess it was deliberate and also not deliberate at the same time. It was interesting because she goes through, obviously, in her childhood, an incredible trauma that shapes the way that she interacts with the world. A lot of the reason why I put that in was because I felt like people might not buy her character unless I had some kind of an explanation for why she was the way that she is, even though she was based on my own personal experience. And maybe that was, like, sort of like a weird, like, vulnerability thing. Like, I'm putting myself on the page, but I need to, like, explain myself or, like, give an explanation for why I feel the way that I feel, because I feel like it's not normal. that's interesting, though. I actually had a special education teacher come up to me once at a signing and say, she teaches kids with autism, and she actually reads them parts of this book aloud. I think a lot of them are, like, nonverbal, like, they don't read fiction typically, but she said they loved Vespertine. She was like, thank you so much for writing an autistic character. And I was like, oh, did I? That's great. but no, that was really touching to hear. So I feel like it's safe to say she's neurodivergent. I feel like I can safely say that. Yeah.
I read a lot of those interactions as she has PTSD from this awful thing that happened to her as a child, but I can see it both ways.
I didn't connect those. I mean, I thought it was like she had these experiences, but also she's just like this and would have been like, so I don't think in my mind I never connected that as being the reason why. It was just also a thing that had happened to her and was awful. So it's one of the reasons I love talking about books, because it's so cool to see how people interpret things, and also then compared to how the author intended it and what comes across in your writing that maybe wasn't intentional, but is beautiful and works out wonderfully.
That's like, we had a little conversation in our chat where I was like, I'm reading this and, like, I have an anxiety disorder and OCD. And I was like, I don't know if I like the protagonist, because she assumes that people don't understand the things that she's going through, kind of thing. And I was like, but then I had a moment where I was like, maybe I just assume everyone is smarter than me all the time, 100%, because I have an anxiety disorder. Like, maybe this is, like, a learning moment for me. And it was Allie who responded and was like, well, yeah, because, like, she has gone through her own stuff. And I was like, I was like, oh, no.
Epiphany.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, oh, no, it's an epiphany moment. I'm annoyed because it doesn't, like, align.
Well, I thought the opposite. I was like, you're more humble than Artemisia is, maybe. She thinks she's
I don't know if it's humble, but, like, self-flagellation or whatever. Like, I'm like, of course everyone's smarter than you, kind of thing. So I'm like, why wouldn't she assume that she got it? Kind of. So, but it was really interesting. And, like, I totally see the kind of connection with neurodivergence and anxiety and potentially autism or anything like that, right? Where it's just kind of like different thought processes. Hey, World Builders, it's Christiana here. Did you know that the World Builders Tavern has a free Discord community for sci-fi and fantasy writers? Join us to get encouragement for that novel you're working on. Participate in our monthly flash fiction challenges, and of course, geek out about world building. There's a link in the show notes, and I expect to see you there.
I think this is a good place for normally we would do a proprietor's pick where Allie would tell us about a different piece of media that we might enjoy if we enjoyed this book. But when we have guests on, we like to instead do a little author plug. So, Margaret, can you tell us as much as you're able to say what you're currently working on or what your next project is or what's coming up for you? What can we expect to see?
Oh my gosh. So I am notoriously a bit cagey about my works in progress that have not been announced.
Basically,
fun.
Yeah.
I just don't want to get readers excited about something that may not actually happen. So I don't have anything else that's been officially announced.
So you have secret things.
Secret, secret special things.
I have secret special things. Yes, it is unfortunately not a Vespertine sequel.
We'll still love it.
Yeah, I'll still read it.
Yeah. Are you continuing in the YA space? Do you think, if you're far comfortable talking, is that like your, like you feel very comfortable there? That's your thing?
Yes, my current projects are all YA fantasy.
Very cool. Nice. Oh, well, we're very excited to read those. So we'll have to keep an eye out then to see what gets announced and what's coming next.
Yeah, if you
next.
Need extra beta readers.
we're all here.
And then I think with that, it is time for last call. So this is the part of the episode where we look at things that our listeners can take away from the world building of, in this case, Vespertine, to apply to their own world building. So again, Margaret, I'm going to put you in the hot seat and call on you first. Is there something that you would recommend to people who are trying to build their own world in terms of advice of how to get started or something that you think is important with world building?
I think probably the thing that was very helpful to me was instead of building the world first, which is what I initially tried to do when I first started writing novels, and I would often get bogged down in the details, what I do now is I try to come up with the characters that I'm interested in writing and in the central relationship that I'm interested in writing, and then building the world around them to facilitate the types of character moments that I want them to have and the development that I want their relationship to have. So I sort of create the world to suit the needs of the characters rather than creating the world first and then getting stuck because I'm trying to mold the characters to the world rather than vice versa.
Yeah, that's really good advice, especially because, it can be so easy to get lost in the, like, nitty-gritty world building of, like, oh, well, what fabric is their clothing made from? When you're like, this is never coming up. I don't need to, I didn't need to spend 2 days researching ancient textiles. Like, this is, Allie, since this was your pick, I'm going to call on you, pick on you. There you go, pun. pick on you next. What do you think that listeners can take away from the world building of Vespertine to enrich their own worlds?
So something Margaret briefly touched on is something that I often work on with clients when I'm editing a manuscript that I'm a developmental editor, that the emotional wound is often what it's referred to as, is something that happens to the main character in the past that affects how they see and interact with the world now. And so I really liked, which it sounded like you sort of added in as an afterthought later, but I really liked this, that Artemisia's emotional wound was being possessed by this Ashgrim as a kid, and how that affects so much of how she sees the world now and just her anxiety. And I just liked how that tied into the world building, because it tied into the whole spirits, possession, saints, it connected with everything. And so I think it's neat to think about, when you're trying to think about how your character sees the world, what happened to them before the novel starts, can help you understand their character and get into their head. Is it, would you agree, Margaret?
That is really good advice. Yeah, that's fantastic advice. I feel like so much of what makes a character believable is that they don't just drop that aspect mm-hmm. of themselves, like their anxiety, yeah. for example. I sometimes will read characters who have anxiety, but it sort of is depending on whether or not it's convenient to the plot in that given yeah. moment, whether they are mm-hmm. having the anxiety or not. And I think it's that really makes me sort of detach from the story when I'm like, it just is not realistic necessarily, yeah. but it's, you know, it's something... Yeah, so no, I think that's great advice.
Something that just turns on and off whenever yeah. the author feels like yeah. it's convenient. Yeah.
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 And then Christiana, what would you take away from either Vespertine or our conversation today that listeners can apply to their world building?
I think for Vespertine is that sometimes the motivating factor isn't good or evil, right? Like when you're looking at the divine mm-hmm. and all that kind of like motivation, realistically, it's not the thing that the protagonist follows. It's to some extent it is, but it's not entirely the thing, right? So you can have these kind of like larger motivating factors that aren't necessarily the be all end all. And I think that's something sometimes people fall into a trap with is that, oh, well, would the god approve of this or not or whatever. It's like you're kind of forgetting that the characters are their own individuals with able to make their own decisions and go for or against that kind of thing. And I think this is a fantastic example, also just a fantastic book, but just like a fantastic example of kind of like you can have a character who believes in something, but it isn't like the be all end all. I feel like sometimes when you have a character who goes with like a black or white view of something, it gets boring.
I liked how almost. At the end the yeah. divine wasn't just evil, she was
yeah
just, she almost was... just like a sad lonely kid who wanted a friend,
like yeah. yeah and like yeah. thinking of like the description too of like moving it from a chessboard to like an ever expanding checkers board kind of thing, right? Like it's not just like someone making one decision because they're evil or they're good and that's it. It's kind of like a stuff is more complicated and stuff is always complicated and maybe even the gods don't know everything, right? And I think that makes for a much more interesting story.
I also like the implication that maybe the lady is like pulling strings or doing yeah. things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for reasons yeah. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. That's what I mean.
Yeah, she is ambiguous. I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And, like, I also like that, like, she isn't purely good as someone might see her. Like, the Revenant makes it, like, and Artemisia even admits it. Like, the lady will sacrifice you. Like, if you, yeah. know, if you're a pawn that needs to get killed so yeah. that the rook can get in there, like, she's gonna do it. So it's like, maybe she's working for the greater good, but, like, she's not
yeah.
particularly nice all the time. Yeah.
That's what I mean. Yeah. I find stories where it's just, like, insert character or like religious figure says this, so we're all gonna do it without question. You're just gonna like,
mm-hmm. okay. yeah,
like people would naturally question that kind of thing. So like yeah. be able to like fudge the lines a little bit and have that gray area.
What's your takeaway, Emma?
I think mine's kind of along the same veins. We have talked about this before, but I just think that Vespertine is such a good example of it. I'm gonna talk about it again, which is just that characters finding out that the world isn't the way that they thought it was going to be without it being like a do it deus ex machina, like Artemisia learning like, oh, this isn't necessarily the way, like magic and the religion doesn't work the way I thought it did. These relics don't work the way I thought it did. Spirits don't work the way I thought it would. And it's not like a, it doesn't feel like a cop out or like, or it doesn't feel like it was like a, oh, I'm just going to put this in because it was fun. It's like, no, this makes sense. And something's changing, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it's changing in an organic way and it really feels like a character discovering something new about the world as opposed to the world changing because it suits the plot. And I think sometimes that's where yeah. those twists can feel unsatisfying, is it's like, oh, this was just done because it's convenient. Like same with the, like, you know, anxiety just going away or that sort of thing, where it's like, no, this is a good way of learning new things about the world or learning new things about the magic system that make sense for the characters and the world. So if that's something, listeners, that you're struggling with or want to know, then you should read this book and see how it's done. It was very, very well.
That's the main takeaway of the podcast is
read this book. It was very good. Unfortunately, though, we have come to closing time. So thank you so much, Margaret, for talking with us today. This has been a fantastic discussion. That's great. And thank you to our listeners for joining us at the tavern. We'd love to keep you longer, but we have silverware that we have to polish, so we've got to kick you out. If you just can't bear the thought of waiting two whole weeks for another episode, join us over on Patreon, patreon.com/worldbuilderstavern, for access to our bonus after-hours shows. You can also connect with us on Twitter at WBTavernPod, on TikTok at worldbuilderstavern, and on Discord, where we are at the World Builders Tavern. Margaret, where can listeners find you on the internet if you want to be found?
So I have a very active Tumblr. It's marrogerson.tumblr.com. I'm also technically on Instagram, but not really. I log in maybe once a month at best these days. I will be there more, though, when I have another book to promote, but not right now.
So keep an eye on Insta for the next project that's coming up.
Yes, that is a good place to follow me if you wish to hear the news of whatever's coming up. And then Tumblr is great if you want memes.
We do wish to hear the news.
We do wish to hear You can probably also follow our Twitter for updates on Margaret, because we will immediately post when there's something new. So. Amazing. So yes, make sure that you follow Margaret on Tumblr. I love that Tumblr is still a thing. I was very obsessed with Tumblr as a teen. So that's fantastic. And of course, you should read Vespertine if you haven't already. It is a great book with excellent world building. We will see you back here in 2 weeks, listeners. But until then, you gotta scram.
Bye.
Get out of here. Bye.